It's March 18th. We are in Shmuel Beis. We're at the end of Perek Yudal, chapter 14. Yoav just got Avshalom back from Geshur after the whole story, how Yoav got the Isha Chachama, the wise woman from Tekoa, to present the story to David. Before we go further, we have to make a little bit of a presentation about Yoav, partially because he's going to be coming up in this story as we go forward, and also because last time there was a little bit of a sense in this room that
not here.
Yeah, it's okay. That Yoav somehow is not one of the great leaders and one of the great Talmidei Chachamim of the Navi. So we need to make some points over here. It's critical that we understand that when you deal with Yoav, you're dealing with one of the great ones, and perhaps not as great as David. It's hard to make judgment calls like that, but David is of the greatest people to ever walk the face of the earth. So I think we're safe to say not as great as David, but nevertheless, Yoav was a giant, and he does not meet the demise that we find some of the other great ones met. Doeg and Achitofel, they lose their chilek and olam haba, they lose a portion of the world to come. Yoav is a great tzaddik, although there's going to be some tumultuousness to his life, which we'll touch on much more when we get to his death in Sefer Malachim, but right now it's important to point out some things about Yoav. He is a complicated character, that's for sure. He's far more complicated than Avshalom. Avshalom, who's going to be the main character in the rebellion, which we're about to get to, but Avshalom is much easier to grasp. Avshalom was a Baal Gaiva. He's a person who had an ego, with good reason. I mean, his ego was fanned by some pretty incredible gifts that he had, but nevertheless, similar to Korach, who rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu, what's fanning the fire is gaiva, is an ego. Yoav, we do not find, has any issue like that, and Yoav, as I said, is complicated. So first, let's point out that we're going to have psukim later that will tell us, not in this story, but in general about Yoav. We're going to have psukim later that are going to tell us that Yoav was a person who was an unbelievable Baal Tzedakah. He was very, very charitable. We know this in several ways. Number one, the Gemara tells us that Yoav's house was like a midbar. It was like a wilderness. Just as a midbar is mufkar lakol, the wilderness is ownerless. Anybody can go into the wilderness and do what they wish in the wilderness. No one can claim it's my wilderness, you don't belong here. Yoav's house was mufkar lakol. It was open to anybody. It was literally open to anybody. You know, we say that about people, that when we want to praise someone about their hospitality, we say, oh, their house is open to anybody. This was literally open to anybody. You could just walk in and get food and find a place to lie down. And it was literally an open place for people to come to. Now, you would imagine, if you have an open house like that, who ends up in your home?
The poor people,
the riffraff, people with no place to go, homeless people, they're going to end up in your home, right? And that was the type of home that Yoav had. That's number one. Number two, we're going to find later that when Yoav, it says that when Yoav would actually give tzedakah to the poor in the city, he wouldn't simply give them a donation. You know, wouldn't simply give them food to eat. He wouldn't even stop at giving them what they lack. De machsoro, as the Torah says, that really the obligation of tzedakah, if we could afford it, is to give as much as the poor person, the same status the poor person used to have before they lost their money, that's what we're supposed to give them back to. The Aruch HaShulchan writes that the reason why we don't do that today is because the need is so great, we're unable to satisfy such a standard of tzedakah. So we're forced, therefore, to sustain poor people at a much lower level. But in theory, if we could afford it, then we would have a requirement to get a poor person back to the status they were before they lost their money. But Yoav went beyond that. Yoav would give the poor the same level of, the same standard of food and other items that he himself had. Whatever he had, he gave to the poor. So if he had some, you know, if he had steak, the poor got steak. If he had some, you know, fine wine, then the poor got fine wine. It didn't matter whether they used to enjoy steak or fine wine before they became poor. It didn't matter. Yoav gave to the poor what Yoav himself had. So here we see an incredible level of generosity, and that incredible level of generosity obviously goes along with an incredible level of dealing with people. As I said, if you have an open house like that, you end up with all kinds of people in your home. And Yoav was fine with that. But perhaps even more astonishing than that, the Gemara tells us that Yoav's house was like a midbar in another way. It was like a wilderness in another way. The wilderness, the midbar, is minuka mikol. It's completely cleaned out. There's nothing there. There's nothing in a wilderness. The reason why it's a wilderness, the reason why it's a desert, is because no one can live there. There's nothing, it doesn't have anything there. Just as it's clean, it's totally clean of anything, Yoav's house was minuka migezel va'arayas. It was completely clean from any hint of gezel, theft, and arayas, and immorality. Meaning there was absolutely no hint whatsoever in Yoav's home of either of those two things. Now you'll say, well, I mean, theft is a pretty bad thing, and arayas, immorality, that's also a pretty bad thing. But the Gemara tells us that about us Jews, about the Yidden, that rubam begezel, most of us stumble someplace when it comes to theft. It's very, very difficult. It's not difficult for most of us to avoid being outright thieves. We would look down at a person who was an outright thief. But that a person should be completely clean of any degree, possible even hint of theft, that's not easy. That's not easy to do. To be completely clean of theft means that, for example, you have to be really, really careful what you do on company time and what you do on your own time. What you do with public funds and what you do with your own funds. How you make use of it. I mean, you got to be really, really, really super, super careful. And Yoav was really, really, really super, super careful. Arayas, immorality. So obviously someone who commits adultery, we would look at with disdain, or someone who does who commits incest. But when we talk about immorality over here, we're not, when we say clean, completely clean, we mean all hints of it completely. That there was nothing that was incorrect. There was no inappropriate
behavior
at all. Nothing. Not even on a very low level. Forget an actual intimate relationship, but even on a very low level, to talk to someone inappropriately, to discuss things with someone inappropriately. Just the house was completely bereft of that. So when you talk about Yoav, you're talking about a person who is not only also on the Sanhedrin, which in the head, one of the heads of the Sanhedrin. So we're talking about a huge Talmud Chacham, but you're talking about a person who is an incredible Baal Chesed, and a person who is very careful with Yirah Shamayim, with fear of heaven, and being careful with Averos. Doesn't go anywhere near theft. Doesn't go anywhere near Arayos. That's who you're talking about with Yoav. So whatever we're going to discuss that's going to paint Yoav in somewhat of a negative light, we have to continually remember that we're talking about its subtleties over here. We're talking about a great person where he is going to make some mistakes. He has already made some mistakes. He killed Avner, which David said was the wrong thing to do. And we're going to find he does some other things wrong as well. But we have to understand that they're very subtle, that it's not black and white, that what Yoav does is wrong. Yoav has reasons for what he does, and his reasons are strong reasons, but at the end of the day, they were incorrect. But it's not that he's coming from some, you know, he's some kind of an aggressive, angry person who just can't control his emotions. You don't say a person like that is bereft of any form of arayos. He obviously can control himself. And more than that, Avshalom, who's going to rebel, a rebellion is perhaps one of the most, one of the strongest expressions of breaking boundaries. A rebellion says, I don't belong where I am. I'm going to break through those boundaries. I'm going to rebel. That's what a rebellion is. A rebellion is, I am calling into question all the boundaries that are currently in place. That's what a rebellion is. Yoav, if you're careful with theft, if that's what you stand for, if you're known as the person who is absolutely clean of theft, then that says you're a person who respects boundaries more than anything else. The respecting what belongs to somebody else is a reflection of respecting boundaries. So in many ways, Yoav is actually just the opposite of Avshalom, where Avshalom breaks down boundaries, ignores boundaries, and we're going to see in the story we're going to learn tonight an extreme expression of that, how he ignores boundaries. Yoav actually stands for respecting boundaries. Now, even so, we've already found that Yoav didn't listen to David. David said that David wanted Avner to live. He let Avner go, and Yoav killed Avner. So he didn't respect what David commanded. And we're going to find that several places where Yoav feels he can overrule David. He does it here. With Avner. What everybody was bothered by last week was that Yoav managed to kind of dupe David into feeling an emotional tie to Avshalom to bring Avshalom back. So Yoav is willing to use his own judgment at times. But we have to be very careful. This is not coming from gaiva. It's not coming from ego. We don't find that Yoav has an ego problem. He respects boundaries. A person with an ego problem doesn't respect boundaries, because an ego says, what do you mean boundaries? I'm above boundaries. I'm greater than boundaries. Boundaries don't apply to me. That's what an ego says. Yoav is absolutely respectful of boundaries. Yoav doesn't have an ego problem. But Yoav is a big Talmud Chacham. Yoav has opinions. And there are times where he's willing to act upon his opinions, even if he knows that David disagrees. That we do find. So Yoav is a complicated person. And those times where we find Yoav doing those things need an explanation. Why does Yoav do that? What is driving him? What's propelling him? So this is something which we're going to have to tackle. But we need that introduction in order to properly appreciate who Yoav is before we begin seeing the rest of the story. So again, where we just left off is that Yoav has brought Avshalom back. And now we're up to Pasuk Chaf Dalet, verse 24. In Perek Yud Dalet, chapter 14, Pasuk Chaf Dalet, verse 24. And tonight, Mirtz Hashem, we'll finish the Perek. So Avshalom is brought back to Yerushalayim. Vayomer HaMelech, and the king, David, said, Yisov El Beiso, let Avshalom go to his house. Ufanai lo yireh, and he should not see my face. Vayivsov Avshalom El Beiso, Avshalom was... he went around to his house. Ufnei HaMelech LaRa'ah, he did not see the face of the king. So even though, as we learned last week, Avshalom managed to pull at David's emotions, Yoav managed to pull at David's emotions and to get him to want Avshalom to come back, nevertheless, David doesn't want to see Avshalom. Now this is this is curious. Why would David bring Avshalom back and then not see him? Now it's going to get even more curious, as you'll see. Avshalom lo haya ish yafa b'chol Yisrael. And like Avshalom, there was no one as beautiful as him in all of the Jewish people. Lehalel ma'od, to be praised very much. Mikaf raglo v'ad kad kado, from the soles of his feet until his head, lo haya b'omum, there was no blemish. Avshalom was a perfect human being. His physical body was perfect, saying there was no blemish. He looked good, and it wasn't just skin deep. It wasn't makeup. He was not just a good looking person. He was the good looking person, and this was a natural thing about Avshalom. Now, the Navi doesn't tell us this explicitly, but the Gemara derives from the next pasuk that Avshalom was a Nazir Olam. He was a Nazir for his entire life. Uvegalchoes rosho, and when he would shave his head, when he would cut the hair off his head, v'hayami ketziyamim v'yamim, and it would be from year to year, asher yigalech, that he would cut his hair, ki chaved alav, because it was heavy upon him, v'yolcho, and he would shear it, v'shakales sarosho, he would weigh the hair of his head, masayim shkalim, it weighed 200 shkalim, be'evan amelech, according to the weight of the king. So the Gemara explains that a regular Nazir, a person says there should be a regular Nazir, which is typically 30 days, so obviously they can't cut their hair. That's one of the prohibitions of a Nazir. They can't eat wine, drink wine or anything of that sort. They can't come in contact with a dead body, and they cannot shave or take a haircut. However, the Gemara says, a Nazir, who is a Nazir Olam, that is forever, that is for his whole life, he can cut his hair when the hair becomes heavy upon him, which in this case the Gemara says, you see from the pasuk, was once a year. Once a year Avshalom would cut his hair. That was acceptable. That was not going against the rules of Nazir. Yes. Now,
so it was once a year, like a normal thing for, or
that? Apparently it was once a year. Apparently that's the case. Now, the weight of his hair was very heavy. That it was 200 shkalim. Apparently, we don't have that. We don't use that as our standard for weights. But it was a very heavy weight, and the reason it was heavy is because Avshalom had beautiful hair. The Gemara tells us that the most striking part of Avshalom's appearance, which that we've already said was perfect, no blemishes, nothing. He looked perfect, looked beautiful. But his hair was the most striking part of his appearance. And it was, apparently, it was heavy, it was thick, it was beautiful. And he would shear it once a year. Now, these two psukim, these two verses that tell us about the beauty of Avshalom and about his hair, are really relevant to his rebellion, which won't take place until the next chapter, till Perek Tes Vav. Chapter 15 is when that rebellion is going to take place, which Mirtz Hashem will learn about next week. But it's brought up over here because at this point the Navi has decided it is critical to the storyline for us to realize what Avshalom's big challenge in life was and where his failing was. His big challenge was ego.
Ego.
Ego, pride. Yeah. And that's where his failing is going to be. As the Pasuk says in Chafein 25, Lehalel me'od, to be very praised. It's not easy to control one's ego when one is constantly being showered with praise. And Avshalom was constantly being showered with praise. That was his big challenge, and it's going to be his failure. Chaf Zayin 27, Vayivoldu le'Avshalom Shloshavanim uvas achas, and Avshalom had three sons and one daughter. Ushma Tamar, his daughter's name was Tamar. And you remember his sister's name was Tamar. He named his daughter Tamar. I imagine there is no coincidence there, that he named his daughter the same name as his sister. And the Navi makes it a point to tell us, he ha'isa isha yafas mara, she was a beautiful woman, which is not surprising, given the fact that Avshalom himself was a beautiful person, so his daughter was a beautiful woman. Now, why is it important for us to know about his children? So we'll see in a moment that it is also critical to the story. Vayeshev Avshalom b'Yerushalayim shnasayim yamim. And Avshalom dwelled in Yerushalayim for 2 years. Ufnei hamelech lo ra'an, he did not see the face of the king. So 2 years have passed since he came back from Geshur, and still David has not made any effort to see Avshalom, and has not made any overtures for Avshalom to come see him. Vayishlach Avshalom al Yoav. So Avshalom sent for Yoav. Lishlovach haso al hamelech, that Yoav should send him to the king. As Avshalom can't just barge in on the king when the king doesn't want to see him, but he figures if Yoav will be the one who will bring him to the king, Yoav can take that liberty. Yoav is willing to go to push the king into things that he didn't necessarily want to do. So Avshalom enlists the help of Yoav. But Yoav didn't want to come to Avshalom. Yoav knows what Avshalom wants, or suspects what Avshalom wants, or has another reason why he doesn't want to go to Avshalom, but he doesn't go. Vayishlach od sheinis, and he sent the second time. Velo ava lavo, and still Yoav doesn't want to go. So Yoav is refusing or resisting Avshalom's attempts to get him to come to see him. Vayomer al avadav, so Avshalom says to his own servants, Re'u chelkas Yoav al yadi, see the portion of Yoav next to me. Look at the portion of Yoav, which is next to my portion. Meaning Yoav had a plot of land next to Avshalom's land. V'lo sham sa'orim, and there he has barley. L'chu v'heitzi suha va'esh, go and light it in fire. Go burn down his barley field. V'yatzisu avde Avshalom esachel ka va'esh, so the servants of Avshalom went and they burned down Yoav's field in fire. So here we have a deliberate act of what's that?
Arson.
Well, yeah, arson, but a deliberate act of damaging of property. Deliberate act of damaging of property by Avshalom against Yoav. Now, what would you call that when you talk about boundaries?
No boundaries.
Right. Again, Avshalom, you see, is willing to, if he wants to get something done, he's willing to burn down somebody else's property. Would Yoav do that?
No.
Absolutely not. It wouldn't even enter his mind to do this. Yoav, who is the quintessential respecting of boundaries, respectful of boundaries. So there's no way he would have done anything like that. Vayakam Yoav vayavo el Avshalom habaisa. So Yoav got up and he went to Avshalom to his house. Vayomer Yoav, and he said to him, Lama hitzisu avadecha es hachelka asher li ba'esh. Why have your servants burned my portion in fire? Again, this is so outside the realm of possibility for Yoav. Like, you go and burn somebody else's field? It doesn't make sense to Yoav. What are you doing? Vayomer Avshalom al Yoav, so Avshalom says to Yoav, Hine shalachi elecha leimor, I sent to you saying, Bo, heina, come here. Ve'eshlecha uscha el hamelech leimor, and I will send you to the king saying, Lama basi mi geshur, why did I come from Geshur? Why did I, Avshalom, come back from Geshur? Tovli od ani sham, it's better for me if I had remained there. Ve'ata, now, ere pnei hamelech, let me see the face of the king, v'im yesh bi avon, and if I have a sin, v'ami sani, so kill me. But let me, don't just keep me in limbo over here, let me see her face. So Yoav says to him, what'd you do this for? So Avshalom says, because I sent you a few times and you didn't come, and I want to send you to the king to get me out of here. Let me go see the king. So, is that an answer?
No.
Right? Again, for Yoav, that's not an answer. What do you mean? You burn somebody else's field because you want me to do something for you? Right? For Yoav, that's impossible. But for Avshalom, that's an answer. Yeah, I wanted something. You weren't coming, so I burned your field down. Vayavo Yoav el Hamelech. So now Yoav does go to the king. Vayaged lo, he told him. Vayikra el Avshalom. So the king calls to Avshalom. Vayavo el Hamelech, and he comes to the king. Vayishtachu lo al apav, and he bows to him on his face. Arza to the ground lifnei Hamelech, before the king. Vayishak Hamelech la Avshalom, and the king kissed to Avshalom. The king kissed Avshalom, but it says li Avshalom, to Avshalom. That's also critical. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay, so, as I said, it's important for us to already know about Avshalom's ego and what his failing is going to be. We already see an expression of that ego over here in that he's willing to cross boundaries. It doesn't matter to him that the field belongs to Yoav. I want Yoav's attention. He's not coming? We'll burn down the field. Avshalom is willing to do that. And that is a reflection of Avshalom's ego. Because when a person has ego, then boundaries become blurred. There's no boundary controls me. Because that's what an ego says. An ego says, I'm bigger than that. I'm larger than that. I don't have boundaries. Yoav is this doesn't make sense to Yoav. So he comes to Avshalom and he says, what are you doing? So Avshalom tells him, I'm trying to send you to the king. Now, Yoav knew that Avshalom was trying to send him to the king. That's why Yoav was avoiding Avshalom in the first place. Yet now, he goes to the king.
Why?
So why would he go? Why didn't he just say to Avshalom, I know what you tried to get me to do, but I'm not going.
Yeah. He doesn't want the rest of his field burned.
Well, Yoav's a pretty strong guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. But he has boundaries.
Okay.
Maybe he might not be able to prevent this. There's no answer that he gets. He goes ahead and caves and goes to the king. And gets
okay. It seems to me that for Yoav, this statement was such a powerful statement. Because since in Yoav's book, you never cross boundaries,
right,
and Avshalom crossed the boundary like as if it was no big deal, and he's willing to answer the question, oh, I was trying to get your attention, and you didn't come. So, to Yoav, that's such a powerful statement. So he goes to the king, because as far as Yoav is concerned, this means that Avshalom is really dead set on going before the king. Now, I would go further and say that Avshalom knew that Yoav was the quintessential respecter of boundaries, and therefore he knew that this statement would impact Yoav very, very much. He knew that, and by burning down the field, he knew he would get Yoav's attention, which he certainly did, and therefore Yoav does go before the king. Now, why is it that the king didn't want to see Avshalom, and Yoav doesn't want to be the one to bring Avshalom before the king? It would seem that Yoav agrees with David's position. Even though Yoav is the one who instigated bringing Avshalom back to Yerushalayim, but when the king doesn't want to see Avshalom, Yoav doesn't try to convince the king otherwise, and he even avoids Avshalom. So what's the king's reason for not wanting to see Avshalom? And Yoav seems to agree with that. So what is the reason? Why would David HaMelech, after bringing Avshalom back to town, doesn't want to see him? The king, David, is well aware of Avshalom's charisma. He's a very charismatic person. That's how he's going to mount the rebellion. It's because he is extremely charismatic. Avshalom did something which the king at first, until the whole story with Yoav and the Isha Chachama, the wise woman, until we have that story, the king does not try to get Avshalom back from his self-imposed exile, because Avshalom killed Amnon. Now, Amnon did something wrong, but did not deserve to be killed for it. And Avshalom kills him. And David recognizes that he can be very influential, and he doesn't want people to get the impression that David sanctions Avshalom in what he's done. Avshalom has a lot of talent, and he's very charismatic. And David is concerned about sanctioning that. Now, was David afraid of a rebellion? I'm not sure if that's the case. I think he was more concerned about influence to do the wrong thing. And so David needs to make it clear that he is not sanctioning Avshalom. And Yoav agrees to this. For all of Yoav's cleverness in getting David to agree to bring Avshalom back, Yoav recognizes the danger of Avshalom, and Yoav doesn't want to encourage Avshalom, David to show that he sanctions Avshalom.
Why would he go through all the hoops of bringing this wise woman to bring him back, and then he brings him back and nobody sees him?
Okay, so why would Yoav bring him back?
Yeah.
So it would seem to me that Yoav understood that Avshalom has a lot to bring to the table. He has a lot of talent. He is very charismatic. He can be a great force for good. A person who is as charismatic as Avshalom can do wonderful things. Can do great things. But it seems that Yoav understood that it would have to, his ego needs to be tempered. And therefore, he recognizes what David wants to do in keeping Avshalom away. In the end, when Avshalom burns down his plot, and he goes to David, and he tells him, it doesn't say that David and Yoav strategized. However, when David does finally call for Avshalom, and he comes before the king, and he bows down, in the last pasuk, in the last verse, in 33, Lamed Gimel, it says, the king kissed to Avshalom, li Avshalom, with a prefix. I saw several Mefarshim here say that when it says to Avshalom, rather than just he kissed him, then the implication is that he kissed him on his hand. It was not an embrace. It was a form of a show of love from the father to the son, but it was not an embrace. The king David, even in calling Avshalom to him, nevertheless made a show of maintaining distance because of this issue. Because Avshalom needs to be contained because of the influence that he could wield. And as we're going to see, he is going to wield that influence. It's going to be in a very terrible way. But that is David's intention. Now, David does love Avshalom. That's why Yoav brought Avshalom back in the first place. Yoav saw that David's heart was really pining for Avshalom. That's why he brought him back. And even after the rebellion, David is going to insist that no one kill Avshalom, because David does love Avshalom and feels that Avshalom still has a lot to contribute, but it has to be tempered. It has to be done properly. So, even though he loves him, David makes a point of maintaining distance from Avshalom. So it should be clear he does not sanction Avshalom in every way. The Gemara tells us, why is it that the children of Avshalom are mentioned over here, that he had three sons and a daughter? So later on, when we get to the rebellion of Avshalom, we're going to find that Avshalom built a great monument for himself called Yad Avshalom. So the pasuk later on, the verse later on is going to say, why did he build a monument for himself? And the verse is going to say, the pasuk is going to say, because he had no children. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean he had no children? It says here explicitly he had three sons and a daughter. He had children. So the Gemara says two answers. One answer, the Gemara says, is he didn't have any children who were fit to take over the kingdom after him. During his rebellion, he recognizes none of his children have the qualities of royalty that I have, and they will not be able to maintain a dynasty. I may be king right now. I usurped my father, but the line is going to end with me. There's not going to be another son of mine that's going to be able to continue the dynasty. Therefore, he makes a monument for himself to show that he was here. The other answer is, the Gemara says, Kol hasorif tfuaso shel chavero. Anybody who burns the grain of his friend, the produce of his friend, eino maniach ben liyarsho. He does not leave over a child to inherit him. Which means that, well, means really one of two things, but it probably means his children predeceased him. He did have children, but they predeceased him, which is why he built the monument. Now, the statement of Chazal, the statement of our sages, is an interesting one. Whoever burns the produce, the tvua of his friend, does not leave over a son to inherit him. Clearly, they're talking about this story. Chazal actually say this verse, this pasuk, that he burned down the produce of Yoav. Now, let's think this through for a moment. Why should it be that someone who burns the produce of his friend, the punishment is that he will not leave over a son to inherit him? What does one thing have to do with the other?
Because usually when you have land, it's Yerusha for his children. When you burn it, you take away that sustenance to help the next generation continue.
Okay, so
it's almost like a midah kenegad
midah. So you're pointing out the land in Eretz Yisrael was their inheritance. Right. It was passed on from one family down to the next, each generation. And he crossed the boundary and he burned down the produce of Yoav's field.
Right.
So you're emphasizing the field more than the produce, but the produce is what's on the field.
Right.
And so, therefore, the midah kenegad midah, the measure for measure, is that Avshalom won't have a next generation.
But allegorically, you can say the produce is the children also, whichever way you look at it. You might have an allegory that the produce is the children.
Okay, so the produce is the fruit of the labor of the person. He works very hard. The Gemara doesn't say one who burns down the garment of a person, that they are punished in this way. And specifically, the tvua, the finished grain, which represents a lot of work. It represents a whole year's worth of work that produced this tvua, that produced this grain. And now Avshalom goes and burns it down. So, therefore, the midah keneged midah, part of the measure for measure, would be that his the fruit of his labor, which is going to be his children, are not going to inherit him. The when Avshalom takes this step and burns the grain of Yoav, and he crosses that boundary, so that's when it is decreed that he's going to no longer have children who will be able to inherit him. And that's why it's brought up over here that he had children. He had three sons and a daughter, and then he burned the field, and that's why later on we find he has no children. But the truth is, even if his children did not die, even if they did not die, Avshalom still would not have a son to inherit him. Why? Because Avshalom will have no inheritance. Why will Avshalom have no inheritance? Because we know the rule that if a person is killed because he was morid b'malchus, because he was rebellious and he was executed by the king, his possessions are transfer ownership to the king. If someone is executed for treason, for being a morid b'malchus, for rebelliousness, then the king keeps that person's possessions. So even if his children would not have predeceased him, Avshalom would not have left over a child to inherit him, not because of not having children, but because of not having an inheritance. All of his assets would be taken over by the king. Now, let's understand that a little bit. Why should it be that if a person is put to death for any sin, he's a murderer, he's an idol worshiper, whatever it is, his children still inherit him. But if he rebels against the king, then his assets go to the king. Why should that be? We're going to find later that Achav, who was a Rasha, is going to use this rule to be self-serving, because he wants the kerem of Navos HaYisraeli. He wants the vineyard of Navos. Navos doesn't want to give it to him, so he has trumped up charges that Navos is treasonous. He has rebelled, and he has Navos executed, and then he takes over his vineyard. So we're going to find later on that he's going to use it to his advantage. Why should the rule be that if a person rebels, their assets now belong to the king?
Well, the king represents Torah.
Well,
it's a connection.
Could represent Torah. If you think about it, someone who rebels, as we keep saying, is breaking out of boundaries, saying, I'm not bound by boundaries. I'm above that. I am now, there's a certain order in place, there's a certain leader and a certain hierarchy, and I'm going to break through that, and I'm going to establish a new hierarchy. So he says, you think the king is in charge of everything because the king has sweeping powers? No, I'm outside of the king's power. That's what a rebellion says. He's killed. What's the most effective way of making it clear that no, he's very much under the power of the king? Because after he's dead, all his assets, including his land, transfers to the king. So it's almost like you think you're outside of the power and the force of the king, you're going to be much more controlled by the king. Everybody else has their own land. Everybody else has their own house. Everybody else has their own property and their own assets. You have nothing. It all gets transferred to the king.
But you're also talking about Abraham's grandchildren. They're left with nothing.
It's true. That's true. It's a general point. It's not only over here. So Avshalom, who doesn't respect boundaries, who burns Yoav's field, and therefore loses the right for his own children to have a future that his children will inherit him, and he is rebellious, and he rebels against the king, so in the end his children predecease him, and all of his assets get transferred to the king himself. Now the king was also his father, but that is what's going to happen over here, in stark contrast to Yoav, who respects boundaries. Now, at this point in the story, if we were to stop here, when Avshalom eventually does rebel, whose side would you predict Yoav will be on? Will he be on Avshalom's side or on David's side?
David.
And that is correct. He's going to be on David's side. He's going to be actually a major part in putting down the rebellion of Avshalom, and that will be the next case in which he defies the law or the Ratzon, the desire of David, because David is going to say, don't kill Avshalom. He'll say it explicitly, and Yoav will kill Avshalom. So we're going to have to deal with that when we get there, about Yoav's, what we can call insubordination, although I don't think you can characterize Yoav as being insubordinate. That's, Yoav was very subordinate. He respected boundaries. So you have to, again, you have to explain over there what it is that's driving Yoav to defy the king, to do differently than the king. Ultimately, Yoav is the one who promotes David. And we'll show that in a moment. However, the Gemara tells us that Yoav really wanted to join the rebellion of Avshalom. He wanted to, but he didn't, because he recognized that David was still very powerful, and therefore he remained with David. Had David been a little bit weaker, it's possible that Yoav would have switched sides and gone off with Avshalom. So this needs to be understood. If Yoav and Avshalom are diametrically opposed, Avshalom does not respect boundaries. He has an ego. And Yoav is absolutely respectful of boundaries and does not have an ego, at least not in that way, then what would attract him to follow Avshalom? That's part of the enigma of Yoav. As I said at the outset, he's a complicated person. Why would that be? And in understanding that, we can also have a little bit of an insight into the times that he did not listen to David. The Gemara tells us that besides Yoav being a great chacham, but we know he was the great warrior. And we've pointed out many times that to be a great warrior in David's time meant that you were a great Talmud Chacham. They went hand in hand. You could not be a Sar Tzava. You couldn't be the general of the army unless you were a huge Talmud Chacham, a huge Torah scholar. And it wasn't just a question of status. It was a question of actual physical power and strength in a war, that no one could hurt Yoav because he was so powerful in Torah. Avner, no one could hurt Avner because he was so great in Torah. Only Yoav was able to trick Avner and kill him. But normally Avner was almost invincible. David himself was invincible in battle for this reason. Shaul was invincible in battle for this reason. They were giants in Torah and in their fear of God, and that made them invincible in battle. There's going to be another person later, Amasa ben Yeser. We'll learn about him. Also, same thing. We'll learn about Benayahu ben Yahuyada. Same thing. We'll learn a lot about these great people. So,
you're not saying that Avshalom was a big Torah scholar.
No. But Yoav was. Yoav was. Avshalom, I don't know. But Yoav certainly was. So, what then would drive Yoav, first of all, to go against David's word on a few occasions, and what would attract him to the rebellion of Avshalom? So, it is clear to me, as I mentioned at the outset, that Yoav is a person who has a cheshbon. He has good reasons for doing what he's doing, even if he's wrong, but it's a subtle mistake that he makes. Remember, when he killed Avner, what was his reason for killing Avner? Because Avner had killed Yoav's brother, Asael, and he says, I'm the Goel Hadam. I am the avenger of his blood. And the truth is, he has a strong argument for that.
Yes, he does.
And we'll see later on why that argument doesn't stand up. But it is a very strong argument. He's not going to listen to David, and he's going to kill Avshalom. What would be his motivation for killing Avshalom? You tell me. Here you have someone who rebelled against the king. He turned the whole country against David. And now the rebellion is put down. So how do you consolidate your kingdom? You execute the rebel, right? There's a lot of logic to killing Avshalom.
Right.
David doesn't want to do it.
Because if he did it once, he could do it again. He could
Right, that's right. Yoav holds that David is hurting the kingdom by having mercy on Avshalom, just as he held with Avner as well. He held that David was hurting the kingdom by keeping Avner alive. Avner, who was the Sartzaba, the general of Shaul and of Mephibosheth, so he holds that this is not the way to consolidate the kingdom. Later on, he is going to kill Amasa. Amasa is going to be the general of Avshalom, and he's going to kill Amasa as well. It's all going to follow the same theme. When he defies David, it's always because he, Yoav, believes that David's mercy or David's humility is misplaced. That it may be a laudable thing that David doesn't want to take revenge against his enemies, but that is not good for the country. And that's why Yoav does what he does. What would attract Yoav to Avshalom? So I submit to you that it can't be because Yoav had rebellious tendencies. We don't find that anywhere. And as we're pointing out, it's the opposite. Yoav respects boundaries. It's going to have to be because when Avshalom eventually does rebel, there's going to be a sense that perhaps Avshalom is better for the country. Because Avshalom's rebellion is going to be part of the punishment to David for Bathsheba. And so it's not going to be clear, do you follow David or do you follow Avshalom? So we're going to have to tackle that when we get into, starting next week, when we get into the actual rebellion itself and where it was coming from and how Avshalom managed to pull off the rebellion. David was a very popular king. Not easy to rebel against a popular king. So how does he pull it off? So we're going to have to discuss over there what would have attracted a person who was not a rebellious person like Yoav to the rebellion of Avshalom. Yeah.
Was there some confusion over who was going to be David's successor?
Well, we know that the successor is Shlomo.
Right.
David had a Navi come to him, Nathan the Navi came to him and told him that Shlomo is going to be the successor.
Right, but for the general public,
right.
most people did not necessarily know.
That's right, they did not necessarily know. Now, just to add to the confusion of the whole rebellion when we get to it, we're going to go over this, Mitzvah Hashem, when we get to each part of the story, but who is going to be the chief advisor of David who is going to defect to Avshalom? Achitophel. Achitophel is going to be the chief advisor of David who's going to defect to Avshalom. Achitophel is also the father of Bathsheba. And Bathsheba's son is
Shlomo.
So Achitophel is going to defect to Avshalom instead of supporting David so that Shlomo will be the next king. That
doesn't make sense.
Right. What does that mean? How does that happen? Right? So we're going to have to see over there what's going on. The different personalities and the way that they play out is very hard to pin down. There's a lot going on over here. Achitophel is going to lose his portion of the world to come. Achitophel, who was great, he's going to fall hard. Unlike Yoav. He's going to fall. But we're going to have to understand him as well. And there's a lot of different personalities here. And then we're going to have the heroes. We're going to have those who support David, and the way that he's going to be helped and supported by those who do, they're also going to have to be understood. So we have a lot to cover. It's going to take several chapters. So this is going to be an ongoing story right now, the rebellion of Avshalom. We'll start it next week, and then after that we'll break for Pesach, and then we'll pick it up again after Pesach.
It still doesn't make sense to me why Yoav would go to such lengths to bring Avshalom back.
Back.
And then be content with him, you know, sitting right. at, you know, in the city and not seeing his father for 2 years. Right. And then that's just, you know, if you're not going to see his father, let him stay where he was.
Exactly.
Maybe he's talking to some of the tshuva change?
Avshalom can still be good for the Jewish people.
Right.
Even if he's not seeing David.
He could have been good for where he was.
Oh, he was out of the country.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.